The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You know, for anybody who's really concerned about sort of the immediate consequences of what a transition period might look like, yes, it's documents. Yes, it's all these other questions. But at the end of the day, it's actually continuity of government on these really, really critical, no failure acceptable areas. Beyond that, I think it's important to note that the work of the new Biden administration is not the work of an ordinary administration. They aren't just implementing sort of new policies and course correcting, on legislative policies or foreign policy or in the way sort of normal administrations do when there's a shift of power between parties. They're talking about, they have a restoration project to depoliticize the Department of Justice, to restore confidence and faith in the intelligence community, to restore like functional day-to-day policy operations and processes that exist. That's a really Herculean task, and it's not going to be any easier if, as it looks to be the case now, they're handed a Republican Senate to work with.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 5th, 2020. November 5th is Guy Fawkes Day. It is also my birthday, so we thought we'd celebrate by having a discussion of the election, where it is, where we are. Are we in a transition now, or are we in a contested election? And so we got together the Lawfare crew, Scott Anderson, David Priest, Jacob Schultz, our deputy managing editor, Quinta Jurassic, our managing editor, and Susan Hennessy, our executive editor. The whole gang is here. And we're just going to dive into it. So it's the Lawfare Podcast, Guy Fawkes Day. We're almost done. All right, Susan, get us started. It is now 6 o'clock on Wednesday evening. What is the state of play as we are recording now?
Yeah, so overall, the state of play is that there's a number, the race is technically, you know, still open. Neither Trump nor Biden has reached 270 electoral votes. As it currently stands, based on at least the New York Times' calling of the race, Joe Biden has 253 electoral votes. Donald Trump has 214. There's a number of critical states that are sort of outstanding, but I think it's safe to say at the moment the momentum is pretty firmly behind Biden, and we're sort of closing in on a point at which it's kind of a matter of when rather than if. So today, both Wisconsin and Michigan were called for Biden. Nevada is still outstanding and is sort of a big question. We should get an update on that, and it's 6 electoral votes later this evening. There's a little bit of sort of strangeness surrounding Arizona. Both Fox and AP have both called the race for Biden. The Trump campaign very strongly disputes that, and it's unclear the extent to which which there's a real question about the outstanding votes. It does appear that there is at least, it's not a wholly fictitious claim. As we suspected from the outset, vote counts in Pennsylvania are coming in very slowly. Donald Trump continues to have more of the counted vote share, but with a large number of sort of outstanding votes coming from strongly Democratic-leaning sets, the Biden campaign and sort of pollsters generally do seem to believe that Biden will ultimately win Pennsylvania by somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 votes. The closer races are in Georgia and North Carolina. Georgia is a genuine toss-up. North Carolina is leaning towards President Trump at this time. So I think at the moment, Biden is either one or two states away from clinching 270. The Trump campaign has filed suits in a number of states and has declared the intention to file a number more. It's unclear, though, whether or not it's unclear that there's any merit to any of those claims. It really is a Hail Mary at this point.
Scott, do you have any background information to add to that before we dive into the many things that will be of interest related to this from Lawfare readers?
Well, sure. I mean, the one thing I would add is that we have seen the Trump campaign really pursue kind of a flurry of activity in really just the last few hours late today. They asserted first that they intend to request a recount in Wisconsin. That is a place where the current margins are underneath the 1% that's required under state law to allow a candidate to request a recount. So it looks like they're on route to do that there. They've also filed lawsuits in a number of cases in Pennsylvania and Michigan. They filed to intervene on existing lawsuits that had been filed by the local Republican parties, essentially contesting state policies about how members of the Republican Party are being allowed to observe the vote counting, particularly of absentee ballots. They're essentially saying, we're not being allowed close enough. We're not being allowed enough access. There's some media skepticism about the validity of these claims, but nonetheless, they're putting them forward and saying, we need to halt the vote until this is directed. In Pennsylvania, they're also contesting a rule change that essentially says, hey, if we think you messed up with your ID in voting, we're going to let you come in and remedy that for a few days past Election Day. And so they've also joined that lawsuit as well, or at least stated an intent to do so. And then we saw in the Supreme Court last night, President Trump, of course, threatened to bring action to the Supreme Court. That did happen today, although it's relatively minor at the moment. The Trump campaign did motion to intervene into existing piece of litigation regarding Pennsylvania and a challenge there to a rule that would allow the state to accept absentee votes postmarked by Election Day for the next several days. The Republican Party has challenged that. The court previously declined to accept an expedited consideration of the matter along kind of party lines, although actually Kavanaugh and Chief Justice joined with the liberals. Justice Barrett sat out of that case as it arose pretty much the day she was confirmed. So that might see some reconsideration there, although it's not clear that the five justices are going to get on board with hearing it on a more expedited basis. Those votes are being segregated out by Pennsylvania so that they can be resolved after the fact. Regardless, none of these really undermine the fundamental votes that are currently being counted. The Supreme Court matter really only addresses votes that have yet to arrive, may arrive in the next few days. Pennsylvania and Michigan were really talking about stalling the proceedings, not stopping, not challenging vote counts. And except for the small extent about those ID remedies, it's not clear how many voters that affects about this ability to kind of cure faulty identification ballots in Pennsylvania. Trump campaign may pursue other legal action. They've strongly suggested they will. But so far, it looks a lot like these sorts of cases are kind of checking the box, clearly trying to do something, trying to slow up and perhaps undermine the legitimacy of the counts in Michigan and Pennsylvania, where they're rapidly losing ground and have lost ground to the Biden campaign. And then checking the box of filing something with the Supreme Court, even though it's something that was already in process and the court has already declined to consider and is unlikely to impact the outcome as far as we can tell at this point.
David, how confident are you at this point that we know where this is heading and there's only one realistically possible answer to that? Is this a delay on the way to the Biden victory that lots of people expected, or is in there, in your judgment, a reasonable possibility, you know, that that's not where it's going?
Yeah, I go back to my political science hat here, Ben, and I look at previous elections that have at least some similarities. And it's pretty clear. The path here is extraordinarily difficult for Trump, and it's quite difficult for Biden, conversely, to lose. That's with a huge asterisk on it. And that's what Scott just said, is we have what may be an unprecedented set of litigations coming. Now, based on what I've seen and what Scott has told me and others, most of those I would put into the frivolous category and not likely to overturn, because any judge is going to demand evidence rather than just interpretation. And that won't affect the votes that are already in that were cast before Election Day. It's more on the margins of those being received late, as I understand it, in most places. So with that caveat, with that asterisk aside, you've really got a path to victory for Biden here that's hard to overcome. The issue really becomes more of a perception management issue. And I think that's where a lot of the discussion has been since last night. Frankly, last night was an embarrassment for so many people, and I'll put myself in this category, for so many people that for weeks or months have been talking about, we won't know on election night. We have too many things that are unknown based on the pandemic and the issues that have come up with absentee and mail-in ballots. So take it easy. Everybody wake up Wednesday and we'll start looking at it then. It was just shocking to me how many people were going, I won't say irrational, but people who were losing their focus on what, in some cases, they themselves had been saying. Part of that's human nature. That's just social psychology in action. But it was a bit disheartening to see the reaction late night last night when people with PTSD from 2016 were catastrophizing. I don't think today you're seeing a lot of catastrophizing. Now it's more what needs to be done in the Biden camp to ensure that the various spaghetti being thrown at the wall to see what sticks, to make sure that it just slides on down the wall.
Does anybody want to make a case that there is a plausible pathway here that does not inevitably lead to the same place? In other words, is there a reasonable case to be made that this election is not all over, but an additional set of sort of ministerial counting acts and sort of figuring out whether Biden wins, you know, how many of the states above and beyond what he needs he wins, or is it really over at this point? Does anybody have a view of that?
I'll make the case that it's certainly not over. Trump has a narrow path, but he has a path. I think the significant thing right now is the questionable Arizona call. So if Arizona, if the AP and Fox calls for Arizona do in fact hold, it's really, really difficult to imagine Trump overcoming that. It essentially means he has to win every outstanding state. That said, it's likely that Trump's going to win North Carolina at this point. It's certainly within the realm of possibility that he's going to win Georgia. That's sort of a dead heat at the moment. The votes in Nevada, while it's tilting towards Biden at the moment, again, very, very close. The more information we have about Pennsylvania, the less likely that seems. You know, so I think that the sort of path is narrowing very, very, very quickly, and sort of over the next couple of hours may well close completely. But I think as we speak right now at 6:15 on Wednesday night, responsibly, we have to say, yes, there is still a plausible path for Trump to win here.
What do you think, Scott?
No, I agree with that entirely. I think we're going to know a lot more by midday tomorrow. By then, we're going to have an update in Arizona and Nevada. Arizona, Vice President Biden seems pretty solidly ahead, but there are some signs that the late vote coming in there is leaning more heavily Republican than it's been in other places. Certainly the Trump campaign has been quite strident and insistent that they're still in the running in Arizona. And then in Nevada, it's really 8,000 vote margin in Vice President Biden's favor. That's underperforming Hillary Clinton in 2016 pretty substantially. There are still late votes to come in. I think we hear about them tomorrow morning into midday, or at least are supposed to. The presumption there is, again, the late votes, which are mostly late cast absentee ballots and kind of drop boxed in votes in person, are going to favor Biden. And people seem pretty comfortable with that assumption. So both Arizona and Nevada, again, some places have already called Arizona, others haven't. But until we really know those with certainty, I would be hesitant to say any sort of confidence. Once those come in with Michigan and Wisconsin called, that's 270 electoral votes. And I think that's the point where you'll still start seeing people really say Biden's the winner.
All right, Quinta, when you look at this situation, which has a volatile element, which is to say a president of, well, let's just say mercurial disposition facing results that are dire for him, but also not quite certain, right? And so you can kind of put off the inevitable, if it is inevitable, you can kind of convince yourself that you're not actually facing that scenario. What are the dangers that you are worried about over the next few days?
Well, I think over the next few days is different from over the next few months. So, and let me explain why I think that is. I am not surprised that so far Trump has taken the approach of basically kicking and screaming and tweeting up a storm and, you know, filing all these lawsuits, many of which do seem to be pretty frivolous, and sort of dragging this out. That seems pretty consistent with his behavior. I will say I have been very struck by how Republican Party leadership has really pushed back on his early claims to victory, both on election night and over the course of the day. You saw a sort of coordinated kind of milquetoast pushback that would be disappointing except for, well, it is disappointing, but it's the most that the party has really mustered itself to offer when it comes to pushing back against the president. And it actually reminds me a lot of when Trump was making noises about firing Robert Mueller, that you got this sort of slew of statements from Mitch McConnell and Marco Rubio saying, you know, it would be a bad idea for the president to do that. And you saw a similar slew of statements today. And all that makes me think that we are not going to see, you know, a kind of like worst case scenario, Trump somehow tries to steal the election through whatever combination of legal and political machinations. We have seen in the past that he is at his most dangerous when the Republican Party in Congress is letting him get away with whatever he wants. And he is at his most constrained when the Republican Party pushes back, which is pretty damning for the party. But because of that pushback, I am, you know, never say never, but I am cautiously optimistic that he will quiet down if and when the count is called for Joe Biden. So I would say just one more thing. Going forward, I think there are two possibilities if there is a Biden victory. One possibility is that Trump, you know, kicks and screams all the way through January 20th and sort of smashes as many things as he can out of petulance on the way out. The other possibility is that he takes a sort of minimal approach and, you know, jets off to Mar-a-Lago and spends the entire transition golfing. I think that presents its own potential problems, but it is a different vision of what a lame duck Trump presidency might look like.
David, you have studied the history of presidents leaving office, shall we say, involuntarily. What can we reasonably expect from Donald Trump to the extent that, you know, he may sincerely believe that he didn't really lose because he's in his own worldview, it's impossible to imagine that he lost. So he's angry, he's bitter, but he's also facing the inevitable. What does it look like, and are there any precedents for it?
We can't really look to history as a guide here because of what Trump has done in the last 4 years, right? He has blown up so many norms about the presidency that you can't look at what even somewhat disgruntled removed presidents have done and apply that to Trump. The worst that we've seen is someone losing an election and almost immediately begin plotting to make a political comeback or to undermine politically the person who won. But we haven't seen somebody who has Trump's temperament or his inclination to overturn most norms surrounding the office. So at a minimum, you have a situation, and let's hope this is the situation, that if Biden does win And if it is confirmed with the Electoral College vote, then the transition goes relatively smoothly, even if not perfectly. At a minimum, I don't think you're going to see Donald Trump attending the inauguration. I think he'll step out, and some predecessors have done that before. Beyond that fit of pique, we haven't seen much in terms of active opposition to the incoming president. I don't know what Trump would or could do in that case, but his past behavior suggests that he will take to Twitter and take to the airwaves, whether it's Fox or whether he quickly starts Trump TV. And he will go back to his behavior of the last 20 years, which is ranting and raving and screaming into the wilderness, which now the wilderness is 48% of the American people. And I think that's more of the danger of the constant screaming of somebody through the transition and beyond, that now has somebody who has validated that, who did not abandon him after seeing his attempt at governance for 4 years. I don't think, but it's hard to say. I mean, all of us have made predictions in the last 4 years that have not held up. I find it hard to believe Trump would do more than that simply because of what Quinta pointed out. You've got leaders within the party that has enabled and supported him backing away subtly, one step at a time, but at least not coming to his active support for his most wild claims now. As things develop in the next few days, assuming they go along the path that is most likely, that should only continue. And that makes it harder for Trump personally to do something that, in a sense, overturns the election result by force. That doesn't mean he's going to make it easy. That doesn't mean that he's going to avoid using the powers of the presidency to their full malign extent before January 20th. That's a different story.
Jacob, one of the actors in this whole period that has gotten a lot of criticism, a lot of demands, are the social media companies. And they are criticized for the aggressive actions that they take, that is in takedowns and suppression of false information. They are also criticized for being insufficiently aggressive with respect to that. And of course, the fact that we have a president who is a disinformation super spreader himself puts an acute problem on this, particularly to the extent he challenges the election results. How have the social media companies done in this stress test of the posture that they're taking in the election crisis?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious to hear what Quinta thinks as well. But the social media companies sort of publicly talked about this, and I think people in the media publicly talked about this as sort of the Super Bowl for the platform. So it's the Super Bowl for Facebook, for Twitter, for YouTube. And I actually think in general, they handled things fairly well. So there's been pretty aggressive action in labeling tweets from Donald Trump, particularly tweets where he makes misleading claims about the electoral process, and notably a tweet where he makes a misleading claim about having won, right? And so in general, Twitter has taken a very aggressive approach, and Facebook has taken a reasonably aggressive approach, albeit the way that Facebook labels posts is different than Twitter. It's much easier to see a post, even if it's labeled on Facebook, whereas on Twitter, it's very difficult. You have to click through and then you see it. So there's been slight differences in how the two big platforms have handled things. But I think in general, the big lesson, at least from my perspective, there are two. The first is that Facebook and Twitter were really clear in advance of the election that they were coming up with concrete policies to respond to the given situations that we kind of all knew were going to happen. We all knew that there were going to be people in the Trump universe who made false claims of victory. We all knew that there were going to be pieces of misinformation bandied about on the websites about voting and about stuff like that. We all knew these things in advance. And Twitter in particular, although also Facebook, I think did a really good job of being clear before all this happened what their policies were so that they were in a position to respond to these things with more legitimacy. But then I think the other thing that's interesting about the social media company's response here is that in some ways, I think it mattered less than we might have expected it to, precisely for the reason that Quinta gave. So Quinta was explaining that there's been this response from prominent Republicans to push back on what Trump has done in terms of making false claims of victory or otherwise inserting himself into the vote counting process. And that's something that almost never happens, that usually a piece of Trump misinformation that's on Twitter doesn't get refuted, just sort of people in the GOP universe, prominent people in the GOP universe, pretend they haven't seen it. They don't have anything to say about it. And the same thing goes for Fox News, right? Often what you'll see is Trump tweet something that gets labeled as misleading, and then the next day it's the headline story on Fox and Friends. But here, the institutions that sort of intervened before the platforms actually, I think, did their job. So Republican senators did their job in pushing back, and Fox News did their job in pushing back. There's a really interesting segment on Fox News where right after Trump at the White House, you know, declares that, frankly, we've won the election, Chris Wallace and a couple other anchors on Fox News are visibly upset that he did this and are talking about how that's not right. It's a bad thing for him to have done this. And I think there's a way in which that takes the pressure off the social media companies, frankly, because there's only so much that a Twitter account can do if it's not tolerated by the broader right-wing media ecosystem.
Quinta, do you agree with that? Is there, you know, among the things that have gone right administratively and organizationally in this election, and there are many of them, which was the subject of our show on Monday, do the social media companies get points for handling this year very differently from the way they handled 4 years ago?
I'm going to give them 2 cheers, not 3, but 2. I agree with Jacob about his description. I don't think they did a great job, but I also don't know what a great job would look like, right? When you have a media environment that includes Fox News and One America News and the president and a sort of really robust and toxic far-right media environment, there's just actually not a lot that Twitter and Facebook can do on their own to keep that from getting out there. That said, you know, there is misinformation that has been flying around recently. There's a bunch of accounts that keep popping up claiming to be the AP's politics feed. I have no idea what the benefit is of creating that and swinging it around. But I don't want to say, you know, there's no misinformation or disinformation that's popping up on social media and confusing people, because there absolutely is. That said, Jacob is completely right. By and large, the big platforms have been doing a good, if not great, job in clamping down on it pretty aggressively. That includes, by the way, you know, labeling and limiting access to the tweets of the president of the United States. If you go and look at Trump's feed, I think like 6 out of the last 10 tweets that he's posted, you have to click through to view them on Twitter because they flag them for users. That said, I would be remiss if I didn't call out YouTube. And here I'm channeling Evelyn Dweck, who co-hosts the Arbiters of Truth miniseries with me, and who has pointed out that YouTube has really flown under the radar in terms of its lack of any kind of preparation for election shenanigans. There's currently a video up on YouTube that is claiming that Trump won the election, and YouTube is refusing to remove it, although it does have a label on it that says that election results are still coming in, which YouTube is putting on all election-related videos. So I think that it's worth flagging that. I think that YouTube is a big asterisk next to the story of the platforms basically did okay. But other than that, I'd say satisfied with how Twitter and Facebook are doing.
And Ben, I'll add one more pessimistic note to Quinta, not that we need to end the social media segment on a sad note, but TikTok as well, I think, is another one of the big platforms that seems to have not responded to this particularly well.
What a surprise.
Yeah, exactly.
A new entrant into the market without U.S. national security priorities in mind is not doing enough as a startup to, you know, limit the spread of disinformation? Do tell.
Yeah, it's a shocker. So Taylor Lorenz, who's a reporter at the New York Times who does a lot of work with TikTok, she tweeted earlier in the day that there was a really high volume of right-leaning, I don't even know how you'd describe them, Republican-aligned groups on TikTok that were propagating sort of misinformation about who'd actually won the election, and that those posts had not been addressed in any sense by TikTok. And I think, you know, part of this is what you said, it's a company with no US presence. The other part of it is that, you know, political journalists are not really spending all of their time on TikTok monitoring what's happening. And then there's also a degree to which, you know, TikTok is a relatively newer platform. They didn't have the 2016 experience. So hopefully in the future, things improve, although I'm not hugely optimistic.
All right. So Scott, assuming that the Trump campaign's litigating positions are as trivial as you and Susan suggest, and that their vote counting position is as hopeless or near hopeless as it appears to be, in the next couple of days, we're going to start entering transition land. And I want to throw out a hypothesis here, which is that Donald Trump will not, you know, may not concede defeat, making the gracious phone call to Joe Biden and then allowing Biden to, you know, announce that the race has been conceded and that he is now the president-elect. But at some point in the next few days, Biden will decide to announce that he's starting a transition, which of course has already started because that's the way transitions work. So explain that process a little bit. What's going to happen and what should we reasonably expect as we move? Again, we're not going to focus on the Environmental Protection Agency or the, you know, the Labor Department, all of which have transitions as well. But in the national security space, transitions are a very, very big deal. What's going to happen?
Well, in an ordinary year, you would expect to see the incoming administration put together teams of people that are often called landing parties that kind of go out into the agencies and begin to embed themselves and work with alongside their predecessors in certain political roles. These people aren't necessarily filling those roles permanently. Often they're just kind of temporary, but they're there to begin getting some institutional memory, getting things in order, getting a sense of the lay of the land, and working with the civil servants to try and understand, okay, here's what our priorities are going to be. Here are the items that are going to be in process we're going to have to think about after January 20th when we are actually in power, and laying the groundwork for that. And that, you know, ordinarily could happen in a matter of days, at least at the initial front. This is a case, though, where if President Trump is resistant to the idea that he's lost, he may push back against that. That said, and that would be a real problem, particularly in the handoff and the cohesiveness of U.S. policy. It is a dead weight, dead loss situation at that point, because the things that are really at risk of being dropped are some certain core items that might be in U.S. interests that there might be even continuity on between the two administrations. But without adequate coordination, that becomes difficult to maintain. There's a risk balls will be dropped, things like that. That said, you know, there is a countervailing factor here, at least, which is that this would be the first time that we have seen a single-term president of one party be defeated after just a single term and replaced by somebody who was involved with the prior administration. And frankly, who, particularly in the national security space, a lot of the people on the Biden campaign are people who were senior officials in the Obama administration. And so they have a good sense of the role, a good sense of the policy initiatives. And frankly, they probably know a lot of the same people still, know a lot of the agenda items. 4 years is a long time. A lot has changed, but not as much as if it were 8 years or 12 years, which is what we've seen new incumbent administrations have to deal with in several prior administrations dating all the way back to the 1970s, right? So there's a chance that that might ease things a little bit. You also have a civil service that is still in place, and that, while frankly all talk of a deep state is largely misplaced in terms of the idea of conspiring against the administration, they are interested in seeing an effective transition and are going to be inclined to do that. And so they will actually start, and often of their own initiative, without waiting for the Trump administration to direct them, preparing transition memos, preparing packages, preparing information, and staging themselves for those first few months of the Biden administration, where they will be doing this a review of the Trump administration's policies, saying, here's what we're going to keep, here's what we're going to adjust, here's what we're going to drop. And that's all stuff the civil service does pretty much on autopilot. So unless the Trump administration actively interferes with that, hopefully a lot of that will still be able to take place. The one real concern, I think, is about things like document retention or efforts by the Trump administration to potentially get rid of records or cover up trails of things that they are worried are going to be scandalous or political, or in a handful of cases, maybe even legally problematic for them after an exit of office. There are laws that are supposed to prohibit that. Hopefully civil servants are taking adequate steps to preserve any records they may have access to. I fully expect, and that's something I think we're worth doing, is thinking about the records we expect to be exist and to be there on January 20th when the Biden administration comes in, and making that very known so that they are adequately preserved in the government. And that hopefully that won't be a problem. But that is one possibility about one way you might see sorts of obstruction that come in if the Trump administration really is resistant to the idea of an effective transition of authority.
Memo to Congress, this is a very good time to send preservation of document notices and as well as document production requests, just so that it is very clear to people that these are materials that Congress has interests in. David.
Yeah, I wanted to build on what Scott said, because I'm flashing back to 20 years ago now when I was at the State Department during one of these transitions from Clinton to George W. Bush. And even at the working level, and this has been true of people that I talked to at senior levels from 2016, is you had the bureaucracies, regardless of who was coming in as the new chief, you had bureaucracies wanting to get involved in the transition, wanting to get these background papers and briefing documents to the transition teams and to the people getting hopefully nominated for these offices through that as part of good government. It was just seen as part of the job. That's what you wanted to do. We all know the story now of 2016, how that largely didn't happen. The Trump transition teams were slow, they were small, and they were not as interested in these things. But you have a different dynamic now, which is in many national security agencies and departments, but more so at the White House itself, you probably don't have the same volume of quality, insightful memoranda and papers, because so much policy, at least at the senior level, has been done by whim. So there is less for the transition teams to take from the bureaucracy in terms of actual getting up to speed. Certainly, that's okay, as Scott said, because many of them are going to be experienced in government from merely 4 years ago. But that is a big difference. And the transition in that purpose is going to be different. But I'll tell you, I just noticed as we were recording this that the Biden-Harris transition website is up. And politically, that's interesting because the election has not been decided yet, but they're creating the expectation of victory through these means, like putting up the transition website. And there is legislation that affects what transition is supposed to be taking place. And you can expect that the Biden team will be building on that to make sure that they're checking all the boxes to immediately have those transition teams in effect as soon as there is an actual victor in the election.
Susan, how concerned are you about the potential rockiness of a transition? And what else are you concerned about as the, assuming we move past the election phase or the vote counting phase and into a transition phase?
Yeah, so unsurprisingly, you know, my biggest concern is the handoff of the handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Transitions are really difficult in the best of circumstances. They're messy. There's huge bureaucracies. There's lots and lots of people. Things fall through the cracks. Oftentimes, you're dealing with entirely new staffs of people. So while I agree with everything that Scott and David were saying about sort of, you know, the professionalism that underlies sort of the agency levels, these are tricky things and they require a lot of sort of sensitivity and knowledge and deftness. And that's a transition under the best of circumstances. This is a transition under the absolute worst of circumstances. It's a transition in a moment in which you would expect the outgoing and incoming administrations to be working in a sort of hand and glove way to facilitate a response to the pandemic that we know, you know, is going to worsen as we go into the winter. As of today, we hit for the first time 100,000 new cases of coronavirus detected in the United States. So I think, you know, for anybody who's really concerned about sort of the immediate consequences of what a transition period might look like, yes, it's documents, yes, it's all these other questions, but at the end of the day, it's actually continuity of government on these really, really critical, no failure acceptable areas. Beyond that, I think it's important to note that the work of the new Biden administration is not the work of an ordinary administration. They aren't just implementing sort of new policies and you know, sort of course correcting, you know, on legislative policies or foreign policy or in the way sort of normal administrations do when there's a shift of power between parties. They're talking about, they have a restoration project to depoliticize the Department of Justice, to restore competence and faith in the intelligence community, to restore like functional day-to-day policy operations and processes that exist. That's a really Herculean task. And it's not going to be any easier if, as it looks to be the case now, they're handed a Republican Senate to work with, and a Republican Senate that is inclined to be pretty obstructionist if their behavior towards the 8 years of President Obama is indication and evidence here. So I think those are the things to be sort of worried and concerned about in the long term. You know, I think sort of the name of the game right now is to get a call, you know, as sort of a consensus understanding of who the president-elect actually is, so that those sort of transition processes can start to begin. And then we have to hope that both Congress and the media and sort of actors within the Trump administration themselves, you know, are faithful stewards of their roles and are willing to inform the public, you know, when things are not functioning as they said it should in this really, really delicate and sensitive period.
All right, we got to wrap up, but I want to go through with each of you and just talk about what your particular concerns over the next few months of assuming we have a transition now, what your concerns with respect to the transition are. And I will, in each of your case, guide it a little bit toward your area. So, Scott, how concerned are you about the possibility of, you know, sort of dramatic and disruptive foreign policy actions, particularly with respect to allies in the sort of lame duck period of the Trump administration?
You know, it's a great question. The honest to goodness truth is that for the most part, if President Trump wanted to severely disrupt most U.S. alliances or U.S. participation in international institutions and organizations, it would have had to start the ball rolling. And in many cases, it has by starting the withdrawal process for several treaties, international agreements like the Open Skies Treaty.
Yeah, as of today, the United States is no longer a member of the Paris Accords on climate.
Exactly. And that's something they started several years ago, just took several years to actually implement. Most treaties, international agreements have at least a 6-month exit window, meaning starting to do that now is going to be very difficult. So if President Trump decided, I'm going to withdraw from the North Atlantic Treaty underlying NATO, President Biden would have the chance to reverse that decision. Same goes for almost any other international agreement. So that's a good thing, that stability. That's by design. That's not a coincidence that the agreements are structured that way. I think a bigger concern is what we're going to see happen potentially on the ground on a variety of fronts for international actors who see a window closing. Think about Vladimir Putin, who has had a particularly pliable president in President Trump, unwilling to confront him. Same goes with President Erdogan, as Quinta and Susan and I wrote earlier this week in relation to the Halk Bank case. A lot of people have a strong incentive now to do some things in the next 80 days that they may have been hesitant to do before for fear of putting President Trump in a particular situation, and that they're not may not have the opportunity to do again, or certainly not for the next 4 years under a Biden administration. So that is the thing that makes me nervous more than anything else. In terms of the actual Trump administration policies, you have to look at their relationship with Iran. That is the place where they have the biggest departure from the Obama administration's worldview. From my perspective, the most damaging and disruptive departure as well. They have been dead set on permanently infringing the ability of the Biden administration to re-enter the JCPOA, to repair a relationship with Iran. And I am worried that they are going to have incentives here to try and burn that relationship as much as possible and damage it to make it harder for the Biden administration to do that. I don't know if they can succeed. I'm skeptical that they can, but they can certainly make it more painful and dangerous along the way. And that's my big concern at this point.
David, I'm curious. The president has been almost since the first day of his presidency at war with the intelligence community. He showed up the first full day of his office at the CIA wall and talked about crowd sizes. What are your concerns about actions toward the intelligence community on his way out the door?
I'm hearing the reports that he is likely to fire everyone from Chris Wray at FBI to Gina Haspel at CIA, to Mark Esper at DOD, and probably reaching down to deputies and undersecretaries if there are people in those positions. I'm actually not too disturbed about that, because there isn't that much time left, and that leaves the vast majority of the bureaucracy there. Guess what? People are used to handling situations without leadership for a short period of time. The New York Times reporting last week was interesting, which suggested that The president has stopped taking his regular intelligence briefings from an intelligence community professional officer briefer, which he surprisingly to many of us had done for roughly 3 years and 9 months of his term. And that now he is receiving briefings only from DNI Ratcliffe himself. To me, that suggests, it's not definitive, but it suggests somewhat of giving up. That is just backing off and saying, I'm done with this. I'm not going to put up with people coming in and telling me the truth and, you know, trying to get me to believe something I don't. So I'm done. However, there is a potential dark side to it, which is perhaps it's because he wants John Ratcliffe to give him the stuff that others were holding back on, perhaps not explicitly, but he was perceiving that they weren't going to tell him what he really wanted to hear about whether it's opponents or opportunities overseas in his post-presidency. So there could be a dark side there. In terms of doing something against the intelligence community beyond that, I don't see too much of a threat with one exception. And that exception is what he does to our international relationships going out the door. Does he try to blow up NATO? Does he, in fact, rupture some relationship in a fundamental way that won't be easy to rebuild immediately upon a new administration taking over? So it wouldn't be a direct action against the intelligence community, but something that could, in a sense, harm the foundation for good intelligence cooperation with other countries. And that would include the possible mass pardoning of people ranging from, you know, Edward Snowden to Jonathan Pollard. I don't know what he's capable of doing, given what past presidents have done on their way out the door with the pardon power. It's frightening to think of what Trump could do.
Jacob, as you look forward over the next few, I guess, 78 days, what are the concerns that particularly alarm you in the transition period?
Yeah, I guess everyone sort of opted for a more longer term concern. I'll be the near term pessimist. One thing that I thought was striking about yesterday was the relatively low number of incidents having to do with any sort of voter intimidation, demonstrations outside of polling places. Obviously, there are no large scale terror attacks or anything like that. But actually today, I think one of the things that's been sobering is that there was one in Michigan and in Philadelphia outside the convention center where they're counting the votes. There are these demonstrations outside of these places where the votes are being counted of Trump supporters who are angry. They think there's been a fraud that's been committed. And I sort of worry that the longer this drags on and the more implausible, hopefully, that it looks that Trump is actually going to win the election, that these sort of incidents of actual attempts to interfere in the electoral process will become increasingly desperate and more high visibility, more desperate, and I mean, maybe more violent. And that's something we recorded this whole podcast on Monday about the chance of election day violence. And thankfully, it seems like that hasn't been the case. But I do worry that as this drags on and as the president's odds, if things go as political commentators have suggested, become increasingly low, that there's going to be more desperate, high-profile, norm-defying action from people who support him in ways that are sort of dangerous to at least the external appearance of democratic stability.
Quinta, wrap us up. You look through the world through black-colored glasses a lot of the time. So what are your particular concerns as you imagine the next few weeks and months?
Well, as you say, I'm definitely a pessimist, so I'll second everything that everyone has already said. Building a little off Jacob's point, I think I am going to be watching very closely what attitude Trump takes in his public statements and tweets toward the potentially upcoming Biden administration, and to what extent he is engaged in an affirmative effort to undermine that administration as somehow illegitimate in whatever form that may take. I do think, looking back at 2016, we often, it's if thinking about what would have happened if Clinton had won, I think that it is easier to have a potentially rosier picture. But I would say, you know, one thing that I was worried about then, if Clinton had won, would have been Trump just tweeting through her administration and constantly, you know, undermining her at every turn and turning a substantial portion of the population into a group that felt that a Clinton administration was not a legitimate government. I'm worried about the same thing now with an upcoming Biden administration, particularly because Trump has a bigger platform now. He has a stronger base of support. I don't think it's a done deal that he will take this approach, but if he does, I worry it could be extremely destabilizing.
On that cheerful note, we are going to leave it there. Susan Hennessy, Quinta Jurassic, Jacob Schultz, David Priest, and Scott Anderson, thank you all so much for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and today it is produced in cooperation with the entire Lawfare High Command Central team. Thanks to everybody for staying up just another few hours to record this. And of course, we are always produced in cooperation with the good folks at Goat Rodeo, our audio engineer. This episode is Ian Enright, the Lord High Proprietor of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And our publicity department is you, the listener. So tweet us, share us on Facebook, pin us on Pinterest, upvote us on Reddit, and of course, make TikTok videos about us if you have downloaded TikTok, which you most certainly should not do. Our merch is available at the Lawfare store. Our music is performed by the one, the only, the Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.